This next report is about an incredibly compelling sound that you probably would assume is pretty much the same all over the world. Turns out the sound of a newborn baby's cry may actually depend on the language spoken by its parents. NPR's Nell Greenfield Boyce reports.
Different languages all have their own particular rhythms and intonations. You can hear this even if you don't understand what's being said. Let's say you suddenly switched to a French radio station.
On profitait des célébrations traditionnelles du...
Or a German one.
Bei den deutschen Herstellern gab es Licht und Schatten.
Well, newborns can hear this difference too. And a new study suggests that when they're crying, they actually try to imitate the general sound of their parents' language. Kathleen Wermke is a researcher at the University of Würzburg in Germany. She says a colleague recently went to the maternity ward of a hospital in Paris.
And she recorded the cries directly after the babies were born during the first days of life.
She recorded 30 French babies, and these cries were compared to ones previously recorded from 30 German babies. Altogether, the research team analyzed the sounds of over 1,000 cries. Wermke says they discovered something interesting. French babies seem to prefer to cry with a rising melody, like this.
That's a French one.
But German babies preferred a falling melody. Wermke says this makes sense because the intonation of the German language typically has a falling melody at the end of phrases, while in French there's a pitch rise.
In general, it seems that the baby recognized or perceived those melodic differences in their mother tongues and are able to reproduce that in their own crying.
She cautions that both groups of babies could and did produce all kinds of cries.
So it would be stupid, of course, that we say, okay, they always cry in this typical French pattern. Of course not.
But the results of this study in the journal Current Biology reveal that overall, the French and German infants had patterns of crying that mirrored their parents' language.
Very often we think, oh, the baby's crying. Oh, this is really frustrating and I don't want him to cry. And I think we should be more aware that crying is a language itself. And the baby is really trying to communicate with us.
The study impressed Tobin Mintz. He's a researcher at the University of Southern California who studies how kids learn language. He says scientists knew from previous work that newborns do recognize the acoustic patterns of their native language.
But what is really novel about this study is showing that they can actually produce these patterns in their cries.
Months before they'd be doing anything like babbling, which has been considered to be the first true linguistic utterances. Mintz says he has kids, but never searched their early cries for hints of language mimicry.
That's not what I was thinking about when they were crying. Certainly when they were very young, it was never entered my mind that that would be even a possibility.
He says newborns must have a surprising degree of vocal control to be able to reproduce sound patterns that they probably first heard in the womb. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
New York State is trying to make it easier and faster for unemployed people to find jobs. The state's Department of Labor has a new tool. It's calling it a major leap forward. It's a computer program designed to match job seekers with the employers most likely to hire them. From member station WNYC in New York, Ilya Maritz explains.
Lisa Berger is one of the very first New Yorkers to test what this computer program can do. She has a couple decades' experience as a publishing executive and more recently as a nonprofit fundraiser. Berger is self-assured, but she says being jobless for nearly a year has rattled her, and she's willing to try something new.
If there's something out there that can help, I think the environment is really bad. I have never in my entire life had a trouble getting a job like this, ever.
And so Berger has come to a job center in Manhattan. After meeting with employment counselor Emily Aponte, she sends off her resume. 5 minutes later, Aponte announces a reply has come in by email.
What do we got? We have 15 job matches that were generated from your resume. thing. So this is an event planning, Associate Director of Event Planning.
The listings Berger is looking at were selected from the state job bank by a computer running a complex mathematical formula, or algorithm. These kinds of equations are also the key element behind Google's internet search results and the movie recommendations Netflix makes. Matt Sigelman says the beauty of algorithms is that they see patterns. Sigelman is the CEO of Burning Glass, a Boston company that developed the job search algorithm Lisa Berger is now testing.
It's actually studying how real people, by the tens of millions, get to jobs that they move into. The technology is designed to learn from past patterns of placements.
For the user, it's different from a keyword job search on Monster.com or Career Builder because the algorithm actually registers whole sentences from resumes. Sigelman says this program mimics the human activity of reading and digesting information. Coca-Cola, Accenture, and Google are some of Burning Glass's clients. Now New York State is as well. But there's a difference. The program is now being used on behalf of job seekers, people like Lisa Berger.
Let's scan down.
Okay. So Vice President, Group Manager.
That's almost exactly what I did in the past.
Berger isn't overly impressed with the jobs the algorithm recommends. Only one really interests her. Director of Strategic Planning at a sports PR company. The description says this position is non-traditional.
Yeah, I liked that because they might then consider a non-traditional candidate.
And it might be a little bit more interesting.
And it also reports to the CEO, managing partner. It does what I like doing best in the corporate world, which is sort of coming up with a strategic plan.
Berger says she'll probably apply, and she did learn something. If she wants to work at a nonprofit, she needs to beef up that part of her resume.
It's highlighting much more of what I used to do versus mm-hmm. what I want to do.
Yeah.
And that's the biggest thing that I think I've learned.
Right now, Minnesota is the only other state to use this kind of fancy math to try to connect workers with jobs. There's no hard data, but a spokesperson for the state says the program has been working well. New York is trying job seeker algorithms as a one-year pilot program. If enough people say they got something out of it, the state labor department says it will make this program permanent. For NPR News, I'm Ilya Meritz in New York.
The government updates its monthly unemployment numbers this morning. In this recession, 7.5 million jobs have already been lost, and the lion's share of them, 75%, were held by men. This means more and more women have become the primary source of income for their families. But here's the problem. Women still don't make as much money as men. NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports.
There are a lot of women who out-earn their husbands or have jobs once held only by men. But when you look at the U.S. economy as a whole, that's not what stands out.
Our labor market still remains highly segregated.
Labor economist Heather Boucher is with the Center for American Progress. She says men have been hit so hard this downturn because they're concentrated in the industries most affected. Construction, auto manufacturing, Wall Street. Those all pay pretty well, too.
So because women are concentrated in caring jobs like childcare workers or nursing or home health aides, many of those are paid far less than comparably skilled male jobs.
Here's how far. A woman today makes 77 cents to a man's dollar. That's a pay gap that's held steady for the past decade. And as men have lost jobs, this gap has hit families hard.
He was the primary breadwinner. So we have, our income went down by over 50%.
Michelle Quinn's husband lost his advertising job in Austin, Texas in January. She works for the state government, but she never imagined the couple would rely only on her job.
I've always kind of bounced around from jobs and never really had the expectation of being like the working career woman. Because we're older, I had the anticipation of starting a family pretty quickly and, resigning from my position. However, due to the economy and our situation, that's no longer a reality.
Quinn does have employer-sponsored health insurance and was able to put her husband on her policy. In that, she's lucky. Joan Entmacher of the National Women's Law Center says women are less likely to have health coverage through work. So when a man loses his job, the whole family is often left uninsured. And Entmacher says there are other disparities for working women.
They are still more likely to work part-time and take time out of the labor force for unpaid caregiving, which lowers their overall earnings and their opportunity to get other benefits, such as retirement benefits.
Entmacher says women have been losing their jobs, too. One group hit even worse than men has been single mothers. Last month, unemployment among single moms hit 11.6%. Overall, women's share of layoffs has been increasing and could go up sharply if state and local governments shed more jobs, like teachers. But the disproportionate losses for men in this downturn have given women's role in the economy a sizable boost. It's pushed their share of jobs toward a symbolic all-time high of 50%. That rise is part of a long-term trend. One reason, Heather Boucher says, it's pure economics.
When you look from the period from the mid-1970s to today, if you are a married couple and you don't have a wife working, your standard of living is exactly the same today as it was back in the mid-1970s, in inflation-adjusted terms. No increase.
Before the recession, working women were essential to helping families get ahead. Now, many are struggling just to help their families get by. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News, Washington.
Many parents are still trying to figure out how to take care of their children who have swine flu and how to protect the rest of the family. Consider, for example, the guidelines on the CDC's website. Some parents and doctors who've seen the CDC's advice say some of it goes too far, even for the most conscientious mom or dad. NPR's Deborah Franklin has the story.
Jen Hodson and her seventh grader, Soleil McDonald, live in Portland, Maine. And when Soleil came down with swine flu a couple of weeks ago, Hodson, like any mother, sprang into action with hand sanitizer, Tylenol, and chicken soup. She called her doctor and looked online at the CDC website to see what they were telling parents. There were some good tips, she said, but then this other stuff.
They said that people who have the H1N1 should be kept kind of segregated from the rest of the household, and that if they have to be in common areas, they should wear face masks and that they should be isolated, basically.
The website said parents should try to stay at least 6 feet from their child. If you must have close contact with a sick person, for example, while holding a sick infant, spend the least amount of time possible in close contact and try to wear a face mask or even an extra protective N95 respirator. There was also this, a step-by-step podcast of how to put on that respirator.
Place the respirator on your face with the nose piece at your fingertips, allowing the headbands to hang freely below your hand. Position
to Jen Hodson, who'd been sitting up at night holding her sick child's hand, that all sounded like mom as fumigator in chief.
I wondered that if the people who wrote it have kids or know what it's like to have kids, that would terrify them. It's like that scene in E.T. where the people come in the suits, you know, it's horrifying.
And that's a big problem, says Dr. Bernard Dreyer, a health literacy researcher and pediatrician at New York University.
People look at this website and sort of get overwhelmed. Oh, my God, am I supposed to do this? Am I supposed to do that? And then they end up not doing anything.
Dr. Dreyer has been working on a much simpler list for the American Academy of Pediatrics.
I would focus on the washing the hands and washing the child's hands. And I would mention using hand sanitizers and getting that in the house.
Teach kids to cough into their elbows or sleeves if they can.
And then I would talk about not sharing spoons and dishes and, you know, washing things down once a day. Those would be the things I would tell them to do.
But what about the mask? Portland mom Jen Hodson has asthma. It's mild, but according to the CDC website, she's one of those people who should wear a mask around anyone with swine flu. Dr. Dreyer's opinion is more nuanced.
It's hard to tell a mother to wear a mask with a kid. You know, if somebody had mild asthma, I would probably not get too excited about it. If it's somebody with real chronic lung disease, really bad asthma, chronic bronchitis, I would be more worried about them, and I would say maybe you should wear a mask.
Dr. Dreyer was so alarmed when he saw the web advice that he fired off a note to the CDC. Dr. Ann Schuchat, who directs the CDC's National Center for Immunization and Respiratory Diseases, told us that the website is a work in progress, always being revised.
As we learn more and as we realize, well, that was confusing, people didn't get it, or it was so long that no one could find the really important part, we're still trying to really find the best ways to get good information out to people that's practical.
So why push that hypervigilance at all? Peter Sandman is a New Jersey risk communication consultant for companies and government agencies. He thinks the problem stems from the CDC's urge to help you take care of your child the way a hospital would.
That's not realistic. It's good-hearted. It's well-intentioned. It's just not smart.
Research shows that public health experts would have better success, he says, if instead of only putting out the very best, most stringent precautions, they gave parents choices. best, good, and good enough.
I suspect if you sat down with the CDC experts who wrote this advice and said, all right, in a realistic situation where a parent can't do all of this, but if they really work hard, they can do some of it, which are the things they should sacrifice and which are the things they should try to hang on to, they'd have answers.
In the meantime, Bernard Dreyer and the American Academy of Pediatrics will be putting out their own how-to list online in the next few weeks. Deborah Franklin, NPR News.
Now let's spin the globe just a bit and visit another oil-producing state, the African nation of Angola on the continent's west coast. There we're going to meet two men who work down the block from one another. They have often wondered about each other but never really spoken. One is American, one is Angolan. One makes big money in the oil business. One makes almost nothing. The relationship of these two strangers illustrates something that economists call the paradox of oil. Here's Hannah Jaffe-Walt with our Planet Money team.
Gregory Scheidler's rent is $20,000 a month. He's the American. He doesn't pay the rent. The company does, the multinational oil company he works for, the reason he's in Luanda, Angola in the first place. And he's got a pretty nice spot.
It's a gated and guarded community with a swimming pool, tennis courts. There's a new shopping mall, the first in the country that's been built. There's a foreign school that's been built to support the children of the primarily of the oil and gas industry. It's a very nice place inside the gates of this place, and it's a completely different country when you walk out.
Gregory does try to walk out every day for lunch, and he walks past people filling up water bottles from air conditioner pipes, people living next door to piles of trash. Gregory basically has no personal relationships with any Angolans, well, except for one, and he's not even really sure that counts. There is this kid he buys chewing gum from every day.
Usually it's not much more than a smile, and so I'm actually quite curious about his life, where he lives, whether he's gotten an education or not. There's a lot of things I don't know about him.
So we, over here at Planet Money, arranged a meeting, the oil man and the gum seller. His name is Mingito. They're in a basement in Angola on two cell phones with a translator, so you'll have to excuse the sound quality.
One of the things that I enjoy about living in Luanda is actually seeing you every day and buying chewing gum from you. And so I was curious, do you like your job?
No. No ghost.
Not really. I don't like it.
It was pretty immediately clear this interaction was not going to be heartwarming. Mingito proceeds to tell Gregory that he hates his job, the police harass him, sometimes beat him because selling on the block is illegal. And he says he does it because he needs the money. He has to support his mom. He's 18 years old and has had 2 years of schooling.
If you could choose, what kind of job would you like to have?
If some good job would come up from a company, I would do anything.
But good jobs don't really come up for people like Mingito. These two people in this room, in this awkward conversation, are what is often called the paradox of oil, also known as the oil curse. Angola is a country with a wealth of natural resources. It's one of Africa's largest oil producers. And yet, 68% of its people live below the poverty line. So what's wrong here? Herman Cohen is a retired U.S. diplomat. He worked in Angola for years. And he says take a look at the Angolan government. The government gets a percentage of the oil that companies like Gregory's produce, and they sell it, make money, and they could spend that money on schools and infrastructure and public health, but most of the time, they don't. Now, when Herman talks here about the state-owned oil company Sonangol, he's talking about the Angolan government.
For example, the state-owned oil company has a private airline. They're involved in all sorts of businesses, and they even invest part of that money in other countries. Well, you know, if you're a private company and you have a lot of money, you're looking to expand your wealth by investing, right? Well, Sonangol is doing that, but the needs of Angola are much too great. They shouldn't be doing that.
Cohen says the Angolan government is behaving like a private company. And as long as that's the case, Gregory could produce hundreds of billions of barrels of Angolan oil, and Mingito would still be selling gum on the street. Hannah Jaffe-Walt, NPR News.
You wouldn't expect Jason Blair at a conference on media ethics. He is, of course, the former reporter whose fictitious stories triggered a huge scandal at the New York Times. Yet, as NPR's David Folkenflik reports, Jason Blair is making an appearance and giving the keynote address today at Washington and Lee University in Lexington, Virginia.
The keynote address is usually reserved for journalistic heroes, people who stood up to pressure from corporate heavies or overzealous prosecutors.
And getting Jason Blair obviously was a departure.
Edward Wasserman is the Knight Professor of Journalism Ethics at Washington and Lee. He says Blair may have some distance from the scandal that forced the New York Times to retract dozens of stories and to oust its top two editors.
I don't know what he's going to say, but he has an interesting tightrope he needs to walk between owning up to his own wrongdoing and using his own example to illuminate larger problems that we might learn something from.
Okay, Jason Blair, time to own up to what you did.
Taking the work of others and not giving them attribution for it. You know, forgery, fakery, you know, making things up, details and characters and individuals and things.
For example, Blair conjured up interviews with fictional veterans of the Iraq War. He fabricated a videotaped confession in the Washington, D.C. sniper case. There was no such video. It all helps to explain why Jason Blair, at the age of 27, was considered the single greatest threat to American journalism. So, what is there about his story that could be of use to aspiring reporters?
I began, wanting to, comfort the afflicted and search for the truth.
Blair says as he was starting his career, he soon became convinced the only way to have the most impact was to get to the New York Times.
Once I was at the best newspaper, I needed to have the best beat. Once I had a better beat, I needed to have an even better one. And somewhere in that climbing, I lost sight of sort of my moral and ethical underpinnings.
Blair says his first lapse was right after September 11th, 2001. He says he made up a name for someone who wouldn't identify himself.
I remember crossing that line and telling myself, man, I'm not going to do that again. Tomorrow, I am going back on the side of angels, and I am going to, do things the way that they are supposed to be done.
Blair seems sincere, compelling, and even contrite. But how much stock can you put in what's said by someone best known for lying?
He is notorious for being the single person to instigate one of the greatest frauds in journalism history.
The entire idea of Blair giving a speech at a conference on ethics just about makes Kelly McBride laugh out loud. She teaches media ethics at the Poynter Institute. McBride says Blair is a case study in dishonesty, not good intentions gone awry.
None of the stories that he was trying to accomplish when he committed his crimes of journalism were the type of stories that change the way we understand who we are or expose any sort of great wrongdoing.
Blair says he takes responsibility for his actions, but he also says his behavior was influenced by depression and by bipolar disorder. And he says the drug use and the alcohol abuse didn't help.
And then in every moment of potential weakness or where I felt I couldn't do something, it was so much easier to jump back over the ethical line.
Blair says he's now clean and sober. He says he's receiving successful treatment for his mental illnesses. Blair started free support groups for others with similar struggles. He now works at a psychiatric outpatient clinic in Virginia. Its director, Michael Oberschneider, told me Blair has been utterly reliable and a true aid to clients there. But I just had to ask Blair, as he's giving this speech at the ethics conference this afternoon,
why should students or faculty members expect to believe you?
It's up to them.
So there's an assignment for those budding journalists in the audience. Figure out whether a dishonest reporter gets another chance to serve up the truth. David Folkenflik, NPR News.